Gogol writes in the portrait that art, the artist, breathes in the world, kind of holds it in his spirit and converts the world into a spiritual substance and then breathes it back out into whatever his medium is. And so spiritual things don't die, right? The spirit is immortal. And it's possible to grant the immortality of your spirit to something that's physical, just in the sheer beauty of the thing that compels people to keep it around and to steward it and to praise it and to glorify it.
The Commonplace is a podcast for the new homeschooling mom delighted by the ideals and principles of a classical Charlotte Mason education, but who feels unsure of how to get started on the practical side of nourishing a soul on the good, the true, and the beautiful. I hope you find camaraderie here as we get our bearings in the world of old ideas and old books, of wisdom and virtue, and of the means of grace by which God works in this world through the commonplaces, which includes your home. So, if you're like me, trying to offer your children an education unlike your own, and wondering if you can create an atmosphere, a discipline, and a life of such richness, I'm here to tell you, I think you can. I'm your host, Autumn Kern, and I'm pleased to welcome you to The Commonplace. Hello and welcome back to The Commonplace. My name is Autumn, and if you are just tuning into this season, we are asking all of the questions that a mom who is new to classical education asks about story. And in our pursuit of answers to these questions, we have special guests for every episode, and today I am joined by Mr. Josh Gibbs. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
I am really excited about this. When I started to list out the questions for the season, I immediately wrote down your name for today's question because it had to be you. And that question is the one that moms frequently ask when they start looking at curricula and seeing the same books listed over and over again. And that's, why does it have to be these books? Which I think at the heart of the question is, why have some stories lasted and why should that matter? So you've recently, I don't know when you wrote it, but it recently came out, Love What Lasts, and it's a tremendous book, one that any listener of The Commonplace or The Common Mom videos has heard me talk about. And so I hope they are already familiar with your name, but if you could kick us off by telling us a little bit more about your work and how you personally came through what I call the classical wardrobe.
Yes, sure. So in 1994, my father retired from the military and my family moved from Newport News, Virginia to Moscow, Idaho, where my sister and I attended Logos School. And that was just high school. That was 9th through 12th grade. And after I graduated, I stayed in Moscow, stayed there for many years. I got married. I lived there for a few years after I married. And toward the end of my time in Moscow, I got a job. First, it was just a job teaching composition at a very small co-op of a school, really a school that only met a few days a week. And I got that invitation because I was a part of a writer's club that included a number of teachers from that school. And I had a little success in the first year I was a teacher, just doing composition. And in my second year, I was asked to teach a history class, then I was asked to teach a literature class. And so by the third year, I was teaching a number of classes at this school. And that wasn't a conventional 5-day-a-week school. A lot of those classes only met once a week for about 75 minutes. It was a lot of superintended study in this kind of big room where all the students worked and teachers oversaw everything. But at the end of that time, I leveraged what success I had at that school for a job at a different school. And I moved to Pensacola, Florida, where I taught for 6 years in a 5-day-a-week classical Christian school. And that was a baptism by fire. That was me teaching a lot of books that I had never read before, me attempting to do a job that I really didn't have a lot of experience in. I think I made some of my big, dumb rookie mistakes at the first school I taught at, only teaching once a week. But there were plenty of other mistakes to make. Anyway, I taught at that school for 6 years, and then I moved to Richmond, Virginia, where I've taught at Veritas for a decade now. And 4 years ago, I started my online classroom, Gibbs Classical. But I guess you could say I was in the right place at the right time. My parents heard a lecture that prevailed against their hearts, and they decided that classical education was the thing their kids needed. So a little bit serendipity, a little bit of me simply needing a job and using what connections I had. I mean, it was kind of, I don't know, 5 or 6 or 7 different things kind of converging in one place that ultimately got me where I am.
Sure. I think a lot of the moms listening to The Commonplace feel like we are also in the place of being baptized by fire, doing jobs that we were not trained to do as we take on homeschooling our children this way. So I love having a few guests this season who were actually classically educated themselves, which is just a unique thing, being both an educator and also understanding what our children are experiencing.
Sure. Yeah. I was homeschooled for a while when I was younger too.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I went to government schools in elementary school. And then for 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, I was homeschooled before my parents put me in a classical school, the classical school in Moscow. So I got a little bit of all three, public schools, homeschooling, and a classical brick and mortar school.
Awesome. Well, I think when moms first come through this wardrobe, it is kind of common sense that we know that there are bad stories and there are good stories and there are some great stories. But because we are moderns, we actually struggle to find good distinctions between these. Sometimes we live in the world of everything subjective. If I like it, who are you to tell me that it's not good? Sometimes we're confused because all of the children love certain books, and so maybe we should just give it to them. And I think what is so helpful in your book is that you have great categories for these things. You use, when speaking about cultural artifacts, the ideas of uncommon, common, and mediocre. And so I was hoping that you could kick us off by explaining what you mean with these terms, and specifically within the context of stories, since that's the artifact we're focusing on today.
Yeah. Well, all cultural artifacts, I think, fall into these three categories. I'm not entirely sure that mediocre things existed in antiquity. In Love What Lasts, I argue that the category of mediocrity largely emerges in the wake of the French Revolution, and especially then in the 20th century. And I think that the 20th century is the time when all the ideas of mediocrity that are sort of latent in the French Revolution actually come to life. I'm not sure that they existed during the 19th century. Anyhow, the common, the uncommon, and the mediocre. The basic distinction between these things is shelf life. How long do they last? How long does a certain cultural artifact last? How long does a book last? How long does a film last? How long does a piece of music last? And the three categories describe loosely about how long a thing will last in the cultural imagination before it comes to be sort of impotent and limp and lifeless and doesn't really communicate anything anymore. And so the common thing is the merely human thing. The common thing lasts about a lifetime. It lasts about 70 years, 75 years. It lasts about 3 generations. And after the 3rd generation, it becomes sort of tinny. It becomes, it loses the emotional appeal that it once had. It ceases to make an emotional sense to us. Not because it's bad, but because it was made in a particular time for a particular time. And it lasted a while, but that time is passing. And so the example that I use in Love What Lasts of a common thing is Tin Pan Alley music, the sort of jazz music of the 1920s and 30s that once upon a time it had a deep emotional resonance with people. Mm-hmm. And it's not cheap music and it's not bad music, but when you hear a Tin Pan Alley song anymore, like Brother Can You Spare a Dime, it doesn't grip you. There was a time when it gripped people. And it's a product of its age, and its age lasted a while. It lasted a human lifetime. I think that there is some great pop music that'll last 75 years. My favorite example in Love Won't Last, the example that I came back to many times, is Bruce Springsteen's Nebraska. I think that's still very good today. I think it'll hold up for another 20 or 30 or 40 years. I think a lot of the Beatles music will hold up for another 20 or 30 years. I don't think that these things are going to last forever, though. I think they eventually are replaced by the new version of the Beatles, by the new version of Springsteen. And so they last a lifetime. And then there's the things that last a lifetime, but then just keep going, that the things that never really go away. And those are the things that I call the uncommon things. And those are things that have some sort of appeal in their own era. And yet, because they are spiritual, because they have tapped into something that's not merely physical, not merely immanent, they don't die like people die. They go on like angels go on. And I'm referring there to the works of Homer or Bach or Augustine or Plato. These are works that have lasted, you know, 20 generations, 30 generations, and they're not going anywhere. You know, Homer's not going anywhere. Homer's never been wildly popular. Homer's never been as popular as Tom Clancy or James Patterson, but he's sold far more copies than either of those fellows because he's just around century after century. And I think that the distinction between common and uncommon is like the distinction between earthly and heavenly. Earthly things are good and heavenly things are very good. And the fact that something isn't holy, the fact that something's not supernatural, doesn't mean it's bad. It just means that it hasn't been set apart for the knowledge of God. So that's common and uncommon. And then around the time of the French Revolution, and especially with the technological advancements of the 20th century, there's this new form of cultural artifact that I call the mediocre. And in Love What Lasts, I acknowledge that the way that I'm using the word mediocre is a bit unusual. I don't think that I'm entirely redefining the term. I did choose the term because I thought it was fitting. But mediocre things are things that are wildly popular when they come out. When they first come out, everyone wants to see them, everyone wants to hear them. And then they die very quickly. We have this incredible interest in them. And then our interest declines rather rapidly. And it's because those things are merely physical. The only interest that we have in them is their sensual impact. And things that are merely sensual are easy to replace. They're easy to replace with things that are even more sensual, right? Which is why the really violent, sexy, lurid films of the 1980s pale in comparison with the violent, sexy, lurid films of today. And it's because when you're dealing in mere sensuality, it's easy to make a thing, you know, quote unquote, more sensual by turning a dial. The argument I make in the book is if loud things are exciting, then louder things are more exciting. If a short skirt is exciting, a shorter skirt is more exciting. And it's just very easy to make those kind of adjustments over time. It doesn't require anything intellectual. It doesn't require any sort of brilliance. It's easy to make a film more exciting, more sexy, more faster paced. Whereas you can't just turn a dial and make a film more brilliant, which is why we hold on to brilliant things whenever they come along. We don't let go of them. It's why we still have Homer and Dante. Like, those things were not around. We didn't celebrate them because they were sensual. They had something very rare. They had the rarest sort of thing. They had beauty and they had wisdom. And because those attributes are so rare, whenever you find them, you just hold on to them with all of your might, which is why we still have them today.
Mm. Thank you. I think that is incredibly helpful. I know I was able, a couple of years ago, I received an audio, we were just talking about this before we hit record, that was kind of like a bonus gift for purchasing something else through the Searcy Institute. And you had laid out this framework. And to me, it felt like scaffolding, that now I could kind of hang things on and understand why certain things I was bringing into my home seemed to nourish us while other things seemed to harm us. And I wasn't exactly at that point able to nail down what it is, because you say this in the book, that sometimes distinguishing between the common and the mediocre is really difficult for people. And I found that was true for me. But as I think about the classical curriculum that a lot of us are looking at, I think about these uncommon books upon which we focus in it. I've noticed an increasingly loud voice about these books. And it's that they've lasted not because there's something really special or holy about them, but rather because they are something to do with racism or sexism. Right. That keeps coming up. And sure. I know that a lot of the commonplace audience, they're very new to the classical world. And so they're very influenced by the things they read on Instagram or the things that moms are saying. And so I think this could be a tripping point. And I know in your book, you have a beautiful section where you explain something called the noetic soul. Yeah. And how the reason things last is actually much more to do with this part of the soul. And when we engage with a book, we're engaging with a substance and a soul. And so I'm hoping that first you could even just explain what the noetic soul is, because I think that's a new term for a lot of people around here, but then also its role in creating something that lasts and also us reading that thing, the noetic soul on both sides.
Yeah, so the title of my book is Love What Lasts. And a thing can last in many different ways. A thing could last just as a sort of physical artifact. And that's not the only way that a thing could last. So, you know, say there was some, you know, say there was some book written, let's say by, you know, let's say by Dante. Let's say that Dante wrote a book that, that no one ever got their hands on. And then some library in Bologna someday, someone discovers long lost book by Dante. And then it's, you know, a book that he made, that he wrote maybe after De Monarchia, and it's a kind of political theory. And this book has not been touched in 700 years. To claim that this book lasted would be true if we're merely talking about a physical object, mm-hmm. right? Or it's possible that in the basement of the Metropolitan, there's a painting from some 18th century romantic that no one has ever seen before. It's kind of been lodged between two works by Caspar David Friedrich, and it's discovered when the, you know, some Met custodian is mopping the floor someday. Those things haven't lasted the way that Virgil has lasted, or the way that Homer right. has lasted. Those things have sort of lasted as physical objects by accident. They are not around because we love them. They're not around because we celebrate them, because we cherish them, because they think that we think that they have something to offer. Those things are around by accident. Mm-hmm. And so when I talk about loving things that last, I don't merely mean things that happen to be around from a long time ago that may have survived simply because they were tucked away in a bomb shelter somewhere. Mm-hmm. The sort of lasting that I'm referring to is a spiritual lasting. And I mean, it doesn't take a whole lot of care for some painting that's lodged between two Friedrichs to accidentally make it.
Right.
Whereas there's all kinds of paintings that have been publicly displayed and that have been debated and argued and shipped all over the world to be shown in, you know, various exhibits and that sort of thing. And those things have lasted in as much as they have survived this gauntlet of human judgment, generation after generation after generation. And I think that there's a reason why some things last and some things don't. I think there's a reason why It's a Wonderful Life is still good 75 years later, and most of the films that came out the year that film came out are not. And it's their lasting quality is not just the sort of physical materiality that, that resides, you know, kind of continues over time. It's that when those things were made, the maker impressed his spirit into those things. He was able to confer his soul onto the object itself, onto the painting, onto the, you know, onto the film itself, into the words of the book, into the lines and the paint on the canvas. Those are like spiritual objects. Gogol says, Gogol writes in the portrait that art, the artist breathes in the world, kind of holds it in his spirit and converts the world into a spiritual substance and then breathes it back out into whatever his medium is. And so spiritual things don't die, right? Spirit is immortal. And it's possible to grant the immortality of your spirit to something that's physical just in the sheer beauty of the thing that compels people to keep it around and to steward it and to praise it and to glorify it. And I think that's why Homer's still around. We didn't have to keep Homer around. And this is always worth pointing out, I think, whenever you get into a debate with someone who's like, well, you know, Homer's a white guy and they always get their way. I would contest that. I do not always get my way. White people always get their way. And Homer's a white people book, Dante's a white people book, white people always get their way, men always get their way. I think that what these claims often ride on is this idea that we somehow are compelled to or forced to keep these things around by this coverted, like this coercive police that makes us be impressed with Milton and makes us be impressed with Dante. As opposed to saying that the thing that draws us to these things is their beauty, and the power of beauty is irresistible. And that the reason why these things last is actually because of an interior power that they themselves have over us. And it's the power that beauty holds over all human beings. So, I mean, we keep Virgil around not because he's like us, but because he's unlike us. We keep Milton around because he's unlike us. I really believe that we keep all these things around because they are very, very other, that there's nothing like them. There's not anything like them apart from these things. Like, there's nothing beautiful like Dante. There's nothing beautiful like Diego Velázquez's paintings. There's nothing beautiful like Botticelli. And that these things we don't keep around because they remind us of us. We actually keep them around because they're the strangest, most otherworldly things we've ever seen. And we know that if we lose them, we've lost this sort of access point to this higher, better world. And and without them, like, we're just completely disoriented. We don't know which way to go.
Yeah, I think that's lovely. And I think as we discuss the need for truth, goodness, and beauty to be held in tandem together, to not overemphasize one part of that, which you also talk about in your book, that we've had times in the Christian world we've really hit truth really hard, but not cared if it was presented beautifully, if it itself was beautiful. And the damage on the imagination, of course, then on the soul, because it makes it hard for us to perceive and contemplate, which is what you point out that the noetic soul does. So I then am just thinking about my own experience coming into this world, which at the time this releases will be about 8 years ago, that I could see that these things were beautiful, that they were otherworldly, and that I needed to learn to love them. But to be honest, after someone who had a very mediocre, average American diet growing up, it was hard to love these things. And I found that even though I was sold on the idea, my imagination was captivated by what I could provide for my children in this beautiful way of educating that I had not had growing up, I found that I really didn't want to read some of these books. I found they were not that interesting to me, and that I did not have the taste for them. But something really encouraging in your book is that actually, hey, what you need to learn to enjoy and engage with these uncommon things is a really steady diet of the common things. Right. So could you tell us how exactly are common things or common stories able to prepare us for the uncommon?
Yeah. So I think that one of the points I make as a sort of framework for this idea is that holy things and common things work on a very different sort of economy. Mm-hmm. And this is a point that I make in the very last chapter of How to Be Unlucky, that when it comes to merely physical things, more is better. You know, if you're hungry, more, you know, a bigger ham sandwich is going to make you less hungry. Mm-hmm. And if you know, when you sit down to read a book like Pride and Prejudice, I mean, if you sit down to read a book like some Cormac McCarthy book that just came out, like, if you want to make the most of your time, you probably ought to read for about an hour. Like, you probably ought to read 30 or 40 pages. You ought to get a couple chapters in whenever you sit down to read it. But holy things are not like this. Holy things work on this very separate economy, where, you know, whoever gets the biggest sandwich is the least hungry when it's over. But it's not true that whoever gets the biggest bite of communion is the holiest when the Lord's Supper is over. And that's because spiritual things are simple. Spiritual things are something one. And our access to these things is total. So it's not like you get more grace if you get a bigger bite of communion. The whole of the grace is communicated through any part of the bread and the wine. So it's not like more spiritual things confer more grace. That's also the reason why most church lectionaries are, you know, 12, 14 verses a day. It's not assumed that you need to read as much of the Bible as you can day by day, because the Bible is a holy book and it works on this different sort of economy. You read a little bit and you mull it over. It's not like Cormac McCarthy. If you only read 14 verses of Cormac McCarthy, you drive yourself nuts. You lose a sense of what was happening in the book and what was going on. So common things and uncommon things, holy things and secular things, have this different sort of economy. But what's fascinating about common things or earthly things is that they're not at odds with holy things. Even though they work on this very separate economy, they're not at odds with each other. 6 days you work, one day you rest, one hallowed day, six unhallowed days.
Right.
But the 6 days of the work week are not this sort of complaint against the Sabbath. And the Sabbath is not a complaint against the work week. Mm-hmm. 6 days of the week you work, and that's not a problem. God didn't hallow those days, and that's fine. It's not like common things are problematic simply because they're not the best and greatest and deepest things imaginable. And that's because human beings cannot live in the constant presence of the best and highest and greatest things imaginable.
Right.
God is at all times and all places filling all things, but he knows that we are finite and that we can't stand that. I mean, you read the Old Testament, you read any of the Bible, and you realize that it's very draining to be in the presence of God. Like, no one's excited when God shows up. Read the Old Testament. No one's excited when God shows yeah. up. They know that things are about to get difficult. They know that he's going to ask them to do something difficult, the way that he asked Jonah to do something, or God's going to show up and his presence is draining on people. Like, think about Moses going up on the mountain. It's like God is, I don't mean this in an impious way, but God, the presence of God is problematic in terms of getting things done. Like, things tend to grind to a halt whenever God shows up. And so God condescends to our limited capacity to deal with him, and he often is sitting at a kind of reserved distance from us, giving us space. We cannot dwell at a distance from him all the time, and so he gives us these, you know, appointed places and means by which to draw close to him. And we have to do this constantly, periodically, regularly, throughout our entire lives. But if we're living the way that we're supposed to, if we're living in the realm of the common and we're giving thanks to God for the things that he provides us, none of the common things that he gives us blunt our receptivity to the holy things of God. Mm-hmm. I do believe that mediocre things blunt our receptivity to God. I do think that the sort of like ultra-sensual entertainments of the world have a tendency of making church seem dumb.
Yes.
I think that Transformers 3 makes church seem silly. I think that, you know, the average, you know, 20, you know, most popular songs in the country are going to make the music you sing at church seem really stupid. Because the church songs are slow and they're not clever and they're not slick and they're not, you know, they're not earworms. And I think that the mediocre things of the world ultimately blunt us to the effect that holy things have on us. Because honestly, mediocre things are just fake holy things. They're not a substitute for common things. They're a substitute for uncommon things. And yet they have this tendency of ruining both uncommon and common things for us. If you have a very steady diet of mediocre things, those become the only kind of things that you can handle. Whereas if you have a diet of common things, uncommon things will make sense to you as well.
Mm-hmm.
That at least is the position of the book.
Yeah, no, this is great. You're opening the door of a question that I think comes on the heels of some of these things. So I think it's encouraging for a mom to realize that the common things are actually very good for them and for their children. I use obviously the word common in everything that I do because I really do believe this sort of idea.
Right.
I think that we often kind of shy away, at least in the West, of talking about how we can do anything to help our children's souls. Mm-hmm. Sounds a little too uncomfortable, maybe like we're trying to earn some righteousness on their behalf. And yet at the same time, moms know through common sense that the things we do matter in the shaping of our children. And so I remember, and I've talked about this before, so hopefully commonplace listeners are following, that when Christ is talking about the different soil of the heart, and he drops, you know, the seed drops, that the seed is not the thing that goes about transforming the soil. The soil has been cultivated. It's either healthy or it's not. And so when I'm listening to you talk about this, I'm thinking about, yes, this is how we provide healthy soil so that through the common things which we can offer, our children are then able to receive the holy thing.
Yes.
But I think that as a mom, what I find, and I think this is true of home educators, we have a unique, remarkable situation where we are not only pursuing these classical ideals during school hours. But if we're in charge of the school table, we're also in charge of the other things going on in our home. And so the pursuit of the transcendentals, of these ideals, we do actually want to embody in everything we do. But living that way or trying to live that way can often feel like we are swimming upstream, that we are just playing whack-a-mole. And on one side of the river, you have the mediocre stories that seem like sirens, just calling to our children all of the time. And they're flashy and they're exciting. And then on the other side, it feels like we're almost the no fun police. Like everywhere we go, we're like, no, we can't listen to that. No, we can't read that. No, we can't watch that.
Right.
And I think you've opened the door here on the question asked in the back of everyone's mind is it really so bad if I just let a little mediocre in? Is it kind of like candy? Will it really harm them? So if you will continue with your last thought and maybe lay out exactly the danger and the risk here.
Yeah, I think that you have to realize that there's no such thing as a free lunch, and that everything in the way that you raise your kids, everything that's convenient now, you will have to pay for on the back end. And I'm not some kind of ultra Puritan who says it is 100% always incorrect to put a movie on for your kids. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that. If you're moving and you've got to get this stuff boxed up because the movers are coming tomorrow and your kids are of such an age that you've got to show them a movie for 2 hours so that you can get stuff done, then you need to do that. But I think that when you do that, you've got to recognize that there will be a cost to this.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that you have to do it doesn't mean that there's no ill effect that comes from it, right? It's a little bit like, say you're on a diet and you go to a friend's wedding and you have to have a piece of cake. Okay, you have to have a piece of cake if you're going to be polite. But it's not like because you have to have a piece of cake, it's not going to have any calories in it. Like if you've made some kind of agreement with yourself that you're not going to eat sweets, and then you have to eat sweets for a friend's wedding, I think that's a perfectly good time to break that vow that you've made. But you should acknowledge there is a quid pro quo,
right?
Right, result of that. And I think that provided that you understand that there's no such thing as a free lunch, that everything has to be paid for, you'll be far more judicious in the kind of compromises that you make when you're raising your kids. Mm-hmm. So. I don't want anyone to read my book and for them to think like, well, this is clearly a guy that never makes compromises. That's not true. I simply acknowledge what I'm going to have to suffer from making these compromises now.
Yeah.
And as often as I can, and as honestly, as often as my wife can, we try to not make decisions that are going to have to be paid for later. We want to pay for everything now. We want to do the hard stuff now. And so when my children were very small, like they just never watched TV, like never. I think that we started like this watch a movie once a week thing with them maybe like 4 or 5 years ago.
Hmm.
That was like one movie a week on Saturday. I don't even think that we've kept up with that. It's like one movie a week has turned into one movie a month.
And how old are they now? I'm sorry.
Yeah, they're 12 and 14 now.
Okay, great.
So I think that, this is largely on my wife, right? Like I went off to work and she was the one that stayed at home. So she had to do the difficult thing here. She never showed them anything on TV, no banal cartoons, nothing to keep them occupied while she made dinner, like nothing. And she just suffered through the consequences of that,
mm-hmm.
Which is often enough, it's crying and distraction and frustration. Yeah. But on the other end, like the longer you do it, the easier it gets. And by the time they're like 12 and 14, it's not even a thing that they think about. And so when I look at them today, like they have no screen addiction. They have no screen time, no screen access, no screen anything. Like all of that was paid for largely by my wife when they were very small, by myself later on. So I would encourage I don't want any poor beleaguered mother out there to think like that she's broken the seal by showing her kids a movie and then like now they're tainted or something like that. Like, let's start over, get some new kids. That's absurd. But I do think that it behooves you to not think of raising your kids merely as a day by day sort of thing, that it's also a week by week and a year by year sort of thing. And that the more you are willing to suffer for your children now, and the more that you're willing to make your children suffer now, the less they're going to have to suffer later, and the more self-controlled they're going to be. And if along the way there are these days where, you know, the cow's in the ditch and you got to get it out on Sunday because that's just how things are, then don't be such an ideologue and a purist that you can't give into that. But also don't make too many excuses for yourself. How about that?
Right. No, I definitely think it's both, for sure. There's a ditch on either side there. I know that in conversations with women, when they are very excited and delighted by what they're learning through classical education, they struggle when they hit situations like family holidays, when all of the grandkids are asking to watch a thing and their kids are running in the pile as well. Yeah. And I found in my own life that I just have to know I'm going to have to hold the line when we get back home.
Right.
Here we want to love the family. We don't want to bring in this feeling of judgment because our kids can't watch this thing or whatever it is. So as long as it's not, you know, something morally corrupt, we're going to let them go sit and enjoy that family time. But all week, I know I will be saying no. No, we're not pulling that up. We're not watching that thing again. It's not happening. And that's just the work of motherhood, as you say, as you keep this long game view in. So as we're thinking about the people with the little guys, and then this is really a two-part question because I think we have two types in the audience. The first being for the mom who has the gaggle of little kids around, and she is able at this point, she's studying, she's learning, she's able to kind of set the direction of her house, how she intends to go, hopefully, God willing. Do you have any advice or counsel for how you start with little ones in introducing the common and the uncommon, or even maybe, as you've mentioned with devices and screens, boundaries might be really helpful to just hold from the beginning?
Yeah. I mean, when it comes to screens for little children, having been a teacher for 18 years and having observed the difference between students that grew up with screens versus students who even in 9th, 10th, and 11th grade have no phones, have no iPads. And having observed, you know, both kinds of children, I can say that the fewer and the less screens in your life, the better. I'm sorry, but that's just the way it is. I mean, it's a little bit like the less meth in your kid's life, the better. It's not.
Plainly.
The less paint chips in your kid's life, the better. The fewer pieces of lead paint your kid eats, the better.
Right.
And I'm not saying that like everything is lost if you have a tough week, but I don't believe that for children screens, and maybe even for adults, I'm not sure that I think of screens. Or at least social media, scrolling media, I think is the big problem. Scrolling media, if you love what lasts, I argue that scrolling media is a uniquely intellectually detrimental kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm at least willing to say this of scrolling media, maybe not of every kind of screen media. I know this is a really fashionable word and I'm really loath to use it, but I think that it's toxic in as much as I don't think that it can be repaired or balanced out. Like, that's what I take the word toxic to mean. So I don't think that chocolate cake is toxic. Like, if you eat a piece of chocolate cake, you might have to jog further or go without butter on your toast for the next 5 days. But it's not toxic. It's not in and of itself going to wreck you. It's a part of this bigger thing that you're doing. Chocolate cake could be a part of a anniversary party, a birthday party, a wedding party. Like, there's a right outlet for it. Like, it serves some purpose. And maybe you've had too much chocolate cake in your life and you really need to scale back on the chocolate cake. And so when you eat a piece of chocolate cake at a friend's wedding, well, you're going to have to pay for that. But it can be paid for. How about that? Chocolate cake can be paid for. I don't think that scrolling media can be paid for. I think it's toxic. Mm-hmm. I think that it's corruptive in and of itself. Kind of in the same way that, like, if you pour bleach in your eyes, you can't look at beautiful things to make up for the effects of the bleach. Like, the bleach is actually taking away your ability to understand beautiful things. Mm-hmm. Like meth is toxic. You're not going to run so much. You can't run off meth. You can't diet off meth. Like, these are poisons that you put in your body. They're corruptive. They corrupt your mind. They corrupt your body. And so I think that there's a lot of parents out there, and I've spoken with many of them over the years, that tend to think of social media, they tend to think of screens in terms of this, they tend to think of it like chocolate cake. And so for, you know, I've lost count of the number of parents I've spoken to who've said stuff like, well, I know that Instagram isn't great, but my child reads Paradise Lost in your class, and he witnesses to the kids on his travel soccer team, and he plays the bass in the church worship band. So I think that it all, you know, kind of evens out in the end. He's got this thing that's not great for him, but, you know, he's got these good things. That's not how it works. I mean, it's a little bit like saying, my kid smokes meth, but he reads Paradise Lost. And so I think, you know, that's not going to even out. It's not going to, because that's not the nature of the thing. Like, a corruptive thing is going to take away your ability to do good things. It's not a sort of balance. And so when it comes to, you know, the kind of exposure that kids get to screens, I think the less you can do, the less you can get away with, the better. There is a 0% chance that you're going to get to your deathbed and be like, man, should have given my kids more screens. That was the problem.
Oh, 100%. Right.
Whereas you're probably going to regard every hour that you spent, every difficult, hard-won hour, keeping them off a screen, making them do something that was less addictive, less fun, less sensual, it'll be worth it in the end. I think that you've got to believe that. You've got to have confidence in the good things that you're giving your kids and the suffering that you're undergoing and that you're asking them to undergo, that it will be worth it in the end.
Yeah, I was reminded when you were speaking, I don't know if this was in Love What Lasts or just something that I've picked up in one of your many articles, that you've taught art history, for so long, and you've seen students no longer able to enjoy a piece of art. Like, it used to be the most exciting day when the projector came out, and now kids just stand in front of it, maybe take a selfie when they go on the trips to the museum, and right. That's it. You know, there isn't any contemplating going on.
That's right, yeah. In the earliest days of my career, Art History Day was like everyone's favorite day because it meant, what's funny, of course, is that it meant that there was going to be a screen in class because I had
the projector.
Yes, I got out the projector and showed this little what do you call it, PowerPoint presentation of like romantic art or neoclassical art. And everyone was always psyched. I was like, all right, put your books away. Get out the projector. Like, I cannot get anyone to care about that anymore. It's like a mood killer. Like, we're going to do art history today. No one is excited anymore.
Wow.
And I mean, it's the same lectures that I was giving. I've been lecturing on the same pieces of art for close to 20 years now. It's just that, like, interest in them has just steadily gone down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just ruins the ability to be able to do the thing. It reminds me of the abolition of man. We're destroying the organ, but still trying to demand the function.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
Just, rather than, like, a modern philosophy seeping in through a grammar book, it's the screen. So you might expect this then as the part two to that question for the older mom with older children who realizes that, yes, I have allowed a taste and a love for the mediocre in my home.
Yeah.
How can they do an about turn?
I think that, I think it depends on how old the kids are and how far gone they are. Okay. So, again, not to beat a dead horse, but if your kid was doing drugs and you let your kid do drugs for years, someday you're like, oh my God, I can't believe I let my kid do drugs. Like, you should probably stop your kid from doing drugs. And the fact that you've waited so long to do this good thing, might make them upset. But I think that too often, I will say this, like, the question that you ask is a very good one. And I've gotten this question many times over the years. And I'm not going to say that for every parent, every situation with every child is salvageable in the next year before your child leaves home. But here's what I will say. Parents are terrified of this idea that many of them have in their head, that if all of a sudden they start caring about their kids will be angry and never forgive them. And that's not true. Your kids might be angry, but this idea that if you start caring about your kid's life and the sort of things that are going into your child's brain and their heart and their soul, and if you sit your child down and you're like, man, I have failed you. I have let you watch and listen to and read garbage for too long. I let you down. There's also a good chance that you have been watching garbage and listening to garbage and reading garbage, and that you need to do some repenting for your own sake, for your own part, not just in failing to govern your child, but in failing to govern yourself. Mm-hmm. I think that if you've let your child go, you've probably let yourself go, and that you're going to need to lead by example, even if you're also compelling your child to come along with you. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that you're going to be like, well, I've just let you listen to too much gangster rap over the years. Only I get to listen to that. Right. Like, I think you have to be willing to, I think you have to be willing to suffer alongside your child and to spend your own time alongside your child. Mm-hmm. You know, to spend your time on films alongside your child. You know, watch movies with your kids. If your kids watch a bunch of like Marvel and DC garbage, like you might have to sit down and watch It's a Wonderful Life with your kids. Not just tell them you do better. You might have to say, we're both going to try harder at this. We're both going to undertake this. Mm-hmm. And I think the children will take it more seriously if the parent is imposing a rule on themselves, as opposed to merely saying, party's over, Junior. We're not doing that anymore. You're not doing that anymore. I'm going to keep drinking as much as I did, watching the same kind of soap operas that I did, but you're going to have to try harder. No kid's going to go along with that. I would hope that the kid would give the parent grief over that. Like, practice what you preach. Physician, heal thyself. Like, work this out on your own. Come back full circle. I think you've got to believe that if your child is upset at first, they will forgive you. I think the idea that your child will be so angry at 17 that you took their Spotify account away, that they will hate you for the rest of their life, is a lie of the devil. That's something that Satan convinces you of so that you let your child keep destroying themselves. So yeah, your kid might be upset. They will get over it though. Like try to see what this looks like when your child is 27 or 37. Like, be willing to acknowledge that the sort of things that frustrate a child about their relationship with their parent at 15 or 16 are the sort of things that they thank you for later on. Like, and this is true with students as well, right? The things that I as a teacher aggravate my students with at 15 or 16 are the things that they often are grateful for in the long run. So, you know, for the parent that's afraid, I let my kid get away with too much for too long, play the long game. Life is long. Your child's going to be 40 someday. Right. And if you don't have a great relationship with them now, it might be worth it to go through a bad relationship with them now so that you can have a better relationship with them later. Honestly, though, I don't think it's going to take that long if you're willing to labor alongside your child.
Mm-hmm. I think that's great. I think when you're in the early years, like I am, you think long game, and you're thinking 17, 18, when they might be leaving your home. And then when you're actually with your 15, 16 year old, you realize the long game is 40, 45. Like, you're still parenting and praying and repenting and rejoicing when they're 65. So I think that's great. Joshua, thank you so much for coming on The Commonplace and for sharing with us today. I want to make sure that everyone can find more of your work. So on your way out here, can you tell us where we can find more of you on the internet?
You can find my work and read more about my books and take my classes at www.gibbsclassical.com. I'm teaching a class right now. Registration is open for a class that I'm doing starting in January called Foundations of Modern Politics. Homeschoolers can take it. Homeschooler parents can take it. I get a lot of adults that sign up for these classes, but a lot of high school age students as well. And you can sign up for the mailing list there, and I'll give you updates on speaking engagements that I have, new books and new classes that I have. So gibbsclassical.com is where you look.
Great. And I will have all that in the episode notes, as well as your work over at Circe, because like I said, I've been reading Josh's work for a long time. And fun fact about his courses, you can audit them. So if you are worried about that coursework, you can join as an audit student.
That's right.
I have checked these out many times myself. So everyone else, thank you so much for being here. I will see you all in 2 weeks. And thank you, Mr. Gibbs.
Thank you. Thank you.